KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's second Forum Hour, Alan Chews has been a book critic for National Public Radio for over two decades. He's also a novelist and short story and travel writer and an editor. And he joins us for the hour ahead to talk about book reviewing and a couple of his recent books, A Trance After Breakfast, which takes us to Bali, New Zealand, and Mexico and the Mexico-U.S. border, and his novel on the life of famed photographer of Native American life, Edward Curtis. An hour with Alan Chews, and your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Since the 1980s, Alan Chews has been book critic for National Public Radio's All Things Considered. He's also the author of three novels, including The Grandmother's Club, The Light Possessed, and To Catch the Lightning, which is the story of Seattle-based photographer Edward Chef Curtis, perhaps one of the greatest photographers of Native American life. Alan Chews has also produced several short story collections, a pair of novellas, and is an editor as well as a writing teacher at George Mason University and at Squaw Valley. A much-traveled resident of both coasts, he's also the author of A Trance After Breakfast and Other Passages, which is a collection of essays that take us to New Zealand, Bali, Mexico, and the U.S.-Mexico border. And Alan Chews joins us for this morning's second Forum Hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Great pleasure to be here, Michael.
Well, let's talk first about Edward Curtis, because not enough people know about him. And I was thinking last hour when we had somebody on from one of the tribes talking about the Klamath River dams. Mm-hmm. Here was this great photographer, thousands of photos in the Smithsonian writings and so forth. Maybe even, as I said, the greatest of all Native American photographers. What drew you to him?
I saw his photographs in the lobby of an art theater, an art movie house in Cambridge, Mass, when I was about 18 years old. I was visiting somebody up there who went to school. And I just fell in love with that work and stayed in my mind until one of those mornings occurred when I'd finished a novel. And you can't go for a day without thinking about the next novel you want to write. So I said to myself, well, hey, Edward Curtis, maybe I'll write a novel about him, which, you know, fools rush in. 10 years of research later, I finished the book.
Well, I thought in reading the novel and in reading your travel essays that there was some perhaps magic involved in your own bifurcated nature, you know, being not only bicoastal but also that whole sense of feeling drawn to one's work and then drawn to one's family and one's obligations, just being split in that way.
Well, but I think writing brings all the shattered parts of our lives together. I mean, whether you're writing essays or whether you're writing fiction or poetry, I think that's how you hold everything together. That's your answer to the usual confusion of the mind that most of the time obtains in our head.
Finding order out of chaos or something along those lines?
Well, yeah. You know, Eliot says, I have shored these fragments against my ruins.
That was the Fisher King. That was not Eliot. Sorry to be the pedant that I am. But this interest in Curtis really flowered, I mean, into this novel. And didn't Marianne Wiggins also do something about Curtis?
Yes. She wrote an experimental memoir in which she was a character herself who had written a screenplay about Curtis. And she used, I guess, a 225-page book. There's about 100 pages of the Curtis marriage. She did not like Curtis as a figure, and she really banged him over the head as a staunch feminist. That's my take on that book.
He wasn't very he was so divided with family and work.
And yet, on his deathbed, his son, Hal, his oldest child, took his hand. All the children are gathered around except his youngest, who stood with the mother in this bitter feud after the divorce. Hal took his hand and said, "You are the best man I have ever known." And, you know, he had to be doing something right. But I realize as we talk, I have to confess, I do see a connection among the novels that I've written. I've
I wrote a novel about John Reed and Louise Bryant. I wrote a novel based on mostly on the life of George O'Keefe, and then this Curtis book.
The O'Keefe book was an autobiography, in fact, wasn't it? Didn't you write a novel as an autobiography about O'Keefe? Or?
No, I did a memoir before memoir was cool, about me and my father. But these three novels, you know, large swatches of Americana, I see looking back at them as my way, you know, as the first-generation American son of a Russian immigrant, as my way of bringing my America together in my imagination. And maybe a trilogy is enough on that subject.
A self-identified Jersey boy who, you know, I was reading your introduction to your travel essays where you were talking about fidgeting and couldn't help remembering. Did you watch The Sopranos?
Oh, yes.
You remember when Anthony Jr. was taken in because he had ADD and they said he was fidgeting? And
right.
Tony said, fidgeting? This is, you know, this is a way of, but your fidgeting has led you into many adventures.
Yeah. He wouldn't pay attention in school, they told my folks. But I guess I had other dreams in my head.
Well, dreams that are sort of in some ways perhaps like Edward Curtis's, that is, of capturing what's in the imagination.
Well, he had, you know, he had a skill, he had a talent, and was on a path to become one of the best-known American portrait photographers of his day. Could have made a very handsome living from it. In fact, he was making good money when he first started out on this project. He put all of his money into these 20 volumes of, photographing all the tribes west of the Mississippi. That was his goal. It was a dream quest, in a way, a kind of vision quest on his part. All of his life came together into that quest.
Even to the point where it became somewhat controversial because he had them putting on native garb when, in many cases, that was not their attire.
Yes, he was attacked by some of the members of the burgeoning field of American anthropology who later, I wouldn't say recanted, but at least put the rest of their colleagues on notice that he was actually a very serious, self-trained ethnographer who really knew what he was doing. But as far as the having people put on their costumes, I mean, he's a poet, a kind of fiction writer with a camera. And, he'd go into a garage where these Navajo grease monkeys were working on a car, and he'd ask them to take off their dirty, grease-stained overalls and put on the costumes or the native garb that they came to work in. And that they had hanging on hooks in the back of the garage, and he would photograph them at that point that I see it as, you know, the highest point of the Indian powers, the highest point of their dignity, because it was a moment that was fast fading, and he wanted to capture the last vestige of American Indian power, imagination, dignity.
In the words of Gene Toomer, capture that soul soon gone.
Yes, because,
and he did. I mean, he was prescient in the fact that he would certainly need to capture it because it was near extinction. It was a passion. It was a mission. And it was it's an extraordinary story. Where did you get the whole scene at the seashore, though, with the woman? And I mean, that was where his epiphany takes place.
He wandered along the shore one morning. You know,
this is in his memoirs? Yes,
in Seattle. And he saw the woman, the clam digger, who was a descendant of Chief Seattle, whose name was given to the city. And she was a very ancient figure, I guess a crone figure we might call her today, which is magical in itself. He photographed her, and that changed everything for him. He understood that he really didn't want to go on photographing figures out of, you know, high society Seattle, that this was his mission, this was his quest.
What was his main contribution as an innovator, in your judgment, with respect to photography, with the art of photography?
Well, Ezra Pound talks about inventors and masters. I think he's more a master than an inventor. He put as much as he knew about the techniques of what was then contemporary photography or modern photography to the use of this quest. He was going to find a way to put modern chemistry, if you will, and chemicals at the service of this great cloud of souls who had lived on this continent for thousands of years. And he saw that they were fading away, and he wanted to capture them.
Talking to Alan Chews, his books include, well, a novel is what we're talking about now. We're going to be talking also about A Trance After Breakfast, but the novel is called To Catch the Lightning, and it's all about Edward Chef Curtis, famed photographer of Native Americans. This could have been a biography. Why was it? Why did you turn it into a novel?
I guess I'm just not a biographer. I would love to write a biography. I just haven't found a figure to do it yet. But there are so many gaps in his life that I think maybe the novelist rushes in to fill the gaps where there is no evidence. So you make imaginative leaps among the various.
That could be a good aphorism. The novelist rushes in to fill the gaps. I kind of like.
Well, I also think of it as the novelist as the fool who rushes in.
Fools rush in, yeah. You've also done a lot of reviewing of novels.
I have.
Most recently, I guess, Joyce Carol Oates, she'll be on with us, I think, next week. And I just finished that novel and found it very compelling, as you did.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about the reviewing process. I mean, we hear people who are regular listeners to NPR hear you a lot. They hear Maureen Corrigan. It's very different because you're kind of a two-minute man where she gets the opportunity to go on at length to a greater degree.
Right.
You have to be a lot more succinct. Than,
you know, Robert Haas once said, hey, you do haikus of reviews. And I guess that's what I do. You know, we don't have a lot of airtime that's given over to reviews on All Things Considered. And so you need to use that airtime as well as you possibly can.
You have to be the master of that craft to put it in 2 minutes, though.
Yes. I learned how to do that by – I started out writing reviews for the Kirkus Review Service in New York City. My first wife saw an advertisement in the Village Voice. It said, writers wanted. She said, you call yourself a writer. Why don't you answer this ad? And I went, and they handed me a book, and they said, come back tomorrow morning with a 10-line review. And that's what I did. And before I knew it, I'd been working with them, delivering a 10-line review every morning for about 2 years.
How do you decide what you want to review?
Well, now it's really what I love, what I care about, or what I hope will be really good. Occasionally, I'll have to do a negative review because I think a book is overblown or silly. I think we're on tonight with a review of the Ralph Nader novel, 750 pages.
The Ralph Nader novel?
Yeah. Yes, right. It's called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. And I think, as the old...
I thought it was only Ralph Nader who could save us.
Well, that's his... Ralph Nader as novelist is trying to save us, yeah.
So this is going to get a ding from you, or is it going to get some critical...
I had some... You know, at 50 pages, I might have lasted, but 750 pages, I wasn't smiling at the end.
Are you still writing for print, too? Reviewing for print?
Yeah, I review for a couple of newspapers around the country and for a couple of magazines here and there.
Well, reading your travel essays, and they're quite good, and you say, in fact, at one point that the best fiction writers are the best travel writers, with which I agree. I think about Paul Theroux and Pico Iyer and people like that.
D.H. Lawrence before all.
And D.H. Lawrence, yeah, Twilight in Italy and all that. This is a collection of 11 essays. They're serious essays, though. In many ways, they're sort of, one might say, masquerading as travel essays when they're really much more contemplative and meditative than that.
Well, I never know. Was it Forster who says, I never know what I think till I see what I say or till I write it down? I tagged along on the trip to Bali, really quite skeptical of what I might find there because I'd heard so many things about the place being so magical and so wondrous. But it won me over. It took me over. And so that's what I wrote about in the title essay, Trance After Breakfast.
Yeah, it's kind of strange to think of a New Jersey boy in Bali just on the face of it. But it was transformative, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It made me understand why I was doing all those years of yoga before I arrived on those shores.
It's important, though, when you're describing the effect on you to just get the sense of place to bring that about. And that takes a novelist's imagination, really, doesn't it?
Well, that's what Lawrence taught me. His theory of travel writing was you go to a place and spend about 2 or 3 days and then you write about it, or you spend 2 or 3 years or 2 or 3 lifetimes, and sort of nothing in between will do.
Well, he also wrote a lot about Mexico, and so did you. Though you wrote a lot about sort of Jewish Mexico, or rabbi in Tijuana, for example.
Yes, I met that. Well, the almost rabbi in Tijuana.
He was a
Methodist minister who went to train at the conservative Jewish seminary in L.A. because he loved Bible study. And before he knew it, he was almost a rabbi. He stopped short of ordination. And then he went to Tijuana because he thought that's the place where he could serve the poor the best. And went to the bishop of Tijuana and said he wanted to convert people to Judaism, and the bishop said okay. He converted a couple of hundred people at a time on the beach at Playas del Tijuana, and opened a kitchen where he fed the poor in a very downtrodden neighborhood in Tijuana, fed them breakfast and dinner every day. And so he had a mission, and a mission of charity. Very interesting man.
It's also a very interesting essay when you go to the border, the U.S.-Mexico border, and you really there are more a reporter almost
yes.
than a travel writer or a fiction writer.
Yes, and that's my investigative cap that I wore then. I shadowed border officers, immigration officers, customs officers, shadowed their drug-sniffing dogs. Went with some of the detectives who were tailing people they thought had leaped the border illegally and were trying to commit crimes. And it was fascinating. I spent a week of nights, all night, every night for a week.
Right by the port of entry.
Right at the port of entry. Yeah. I stood in the booths as people came across the border. I ran with the dogs, saw vast amounts of heroin in the storage rooms that the agents had confiscated. And I saw with my own eyes people so desperate to find work and, I guess you have to say, be free. They were stashed away under the hoods of cars, under the engines of cars, children under the trunks in secret compartments. So it's not just drugs that came across that border, but, the aspiring masses of Mexico trying to better their lives.
Really drawn to that kind of writing? Because it's unusual for you to some degree, isn't it?
Yes.
That kind of reportage. And
yes, but...
investigative.
I enjoyed doing it. So sometimes I guess I just twiddle around with my soul, and sometimes I go out and look at the world around me.
You're a man of many colors, as they said of Prince Hal. But you're also... calling yourself the pilgrim or pilgrim because
these people were making this peregrination across the border from their world to ours, from one world to the other. So it seemed appropriate. And I was just wandering around looking, trying to soak everything up.
Well, a quote that I like that really struck me, how the heart learns, we're talking about travel now, mm-hmm. about itself in relation to the world, making the foreign familiar and the familiar slightly foreign. That's really quite a nice turn of phrasing, and it suggests what so much of this travel has done to you. For example, New Zealand made the foreign familiar how?
New Zealand could have been invented for a Spielberg movie because it contains geographically, topographically, it just brings together so many different varieties of landscape. It's got Alps.
I thought it was for Lord of the Rings that it was.
But it's got Alps, it's got fjords, it's got great plains like Kansas and Montana, and it's got booming cities, and it's got tropical beaches, and just an extraordinary place, a storybook place that's an actual geographical location and formation. All of these people so far away from everything on this amazing geographical creation really intrigued me.
You fell in love with New Zealand and Bali, really, didn't
yes.
you?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not overstating it.
No, it's true. And then I have to ask myself, why not Cleveland?
Well, or why not Santa Cruz?
Actually, I just sold an essay about 35 years in Santa Cruz, living there every summer for 35 years, to Gourmet. And fortunately, the check cleared and Gourmet has folded. So if anyone...
Yeah, we had Ruth Reichel and she had no idea that,
is that right?
At the time. I mean, somebody sent me an email the day after and said, why didn't you ask her? Because she didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's a wonderful editor and I owe her a lot because she sent me to those places.
But you were drawn to this coast, again, mainly because of change of seasons and that restlessness and fidgeting? You've lived this bi-coastal life.
Yeah. Talking about pilgrimages, I followed my second wife to California before we married. I met her, and she was a graduate student in Santa Cruz. And I fell in love with the place. The fog, the sea, the sun, perfect climate for me to sit and type while the fog is hovering over us. And
still using a typewriter?
Well, a keyboard.
Oh, okay. I mean, there are some writers around of our vintage who still use the old standard typewriters, you know, Royal or something like that. In traveling, you write about soul travel. I use that word soul, in fact. You know, in fact, it reminded me of Emerson, that you bring your soul with you wherever you go. But travel also, as you point out, opens you up in so many different ways, makes you see differently, doesn't it?
It does. And I realize, you know, having written these essays, that all writing is really travel writing. You know, you connect a noun to a verb and off you go. Whatever kind of sentence you want to make, talking about Emerson, from his beautiful sentences to Lawrence's sort of rough and scraggly sentences to, you know, Hemingway's declarative sentences, to whatever sentences we happen to write ourselves in these days. Like, you know, Richard Fortas has said some wonderful things about American sentences. Clifton Fadiman, in a review, early review of Faulkner, he said the Faulkner sentence is a life sentence. But in any case, you know, that's where travel begins. I think you make a sentence on the page, and if it engages the reader is off on a journey in the imagination and in the endocrinological system.
You like to get into your reader's hormones, do you? Is that what you're saying? Endocrinological system, huh?
Well, I think we have that effect on people. I mean, think about, you know, when you hear a lyric poem and you get a feeling at the end, that's your endocrinological critic in you saying, this is wonderful.
You read Nicholson Baker's new book?
No, I hesitated to read it because for the last 5.5 years, my novelist friend and I, Nicholas Del Banco and I, were writing a textbook for McGraw-Hill, 3 volumes, fiction, poetry, and drama. It's called Literature, Craft, and Voice, and we just finished it this winter. And so I think I wanted to stay away from people collecting poems and rubbing them together for a while.
Well, it really does talk about what you just spoke about, though, the effect of poetry on us and the impact it has on us. And it's all about kind of immersion, really, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's what you do in your travel writing. You immerse us into these worlds.
Actually, like that image. I like that image that you just put out. Yes. In the same way that we try to teach people English by immersion, I think you can help people recharge or charge their souls for the first time by putting them into these imaginative sentences and paragraphs and stories. It makes you feel another way, which you may not have felt before. And if you have felt it, it allows you to continue to raise your, I won't say endocrinological system again, to your feeling, help you raise your feeling self to a new level.
Always like also what Adrian Rich said, what we see, and seeing is changing.
Uh-huh.
You're going through not only feeling internally changes, but vision.
Yes.
Ideally. Alan Chews is our guest. He's the author of A Trance After Breakfast and a Catch the Lightning book critic for NPR's All Things Considered. He'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera on the 14th of October and the Get Lost Travel Bookstore in San Francisco on the 15th. And you can join us if you have questions or comments. We're talking about fiction writing, about poetry writing, about travel writing, but also really about book reviewing and what books do and the transformative power that they have. All of that and more. Again, we welcome your calls. It's toll-free to join us, 866-733-6786, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Join the program with any questions or comments, 866-733-6786. Particularly like to hear maybe from some travelers to Bali or New Zealand and your impressions. You can also send an email to forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Alan Chews, and we're talking about all kinds of things with Alan because he has a novel about Native American or photographer of Native Americans, Edward Chef Curtis, and some of you may want to indeed respond to Curtis's life, which is wrapped into the novel To Catch the Lightning, or his work, which I know many of you have seen. And as I said, we're talking about travel as well. And his book, Trance After Breakfast, is all about travel to New Zealand and Bali and to particularly parts of Mexico, including really the border, the port of entry between Mexico and the United States, and Tijuana, where he writes a lot about well, Jewish culture, in fact, and historically looks at the movement of Jews from European countries to Mexico. Very ambitious essay, I might add. And you are welcome to join the program. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. Questions about book reviewing or travel writing or whatever's on your mind, you can also email us, forum@kqed.org. And a reminder that those of you interested in meeting the book critic from NPR's All Things Considered have an opportunity to do so at Book Passage on October 14th and at Get Lost Travel Bookstores, where he'll be appearing on the 15th of October. Our callers are appearing now. And Richard, you're up first. Good morning.
Good morning. I have two short questions for Ellen. Is it too much of a stretch to see a connection between Edward Curtis and Ken Burns in that idea of documentation with a deep, you know, feeling to a deep soulness? And two, could you tell us something about Edward Curtis when he met Teddy Roosevelt, who gave him a letter of introduction to J.P. Morgan, and that brought about the financing of his books?
That's all in the novel. In fact, Teddy Roosevelt wrote the foreword to Curtis's book.
Yeah. Roosevelt wrote the foreword to the 20 volumes of The North American Indian. But I like your idea about Burns. That hadn't occurred to me. I think you may be right. Somewhere out there, mm-hmm. somebody will do a study of that kind of...
Somebody's on their way in a PhD dissertation, no doubt.
Even as you just spoke, Richard. But he got an introduction to... Roosevelt because he had won a contest for being a great portrait photographer, but he also knew some of the members of the Smithsonian. He actually rescued a group of Smithsonian experts who were trapped on Mount Rainier when he happened to be up there with a climbing club whom he was photographing. And so he had very good introduction to Roosevelt, and he told Roosevelt that what he had done, how much money of his own he had put in this project, and Roosevelt said, "Well, I'll introduce you to Morgan, J.P. Morgan," and Morgan put up a very large amount of money, what was a large amount of money at the time, and they started publishing the first volume, and that went on for about 10 years till Morgan's death, and then financing again became very rocky.
That was unusual, though, to have a patron like Morgan for an artist, which is really what Curtis was.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, Americans didn't have patrons the way the Europeans did.
Right. But, I mean, it does say something positive about Morgan, a man about whom one might not find so much positive about.
You know, when you're writing about people like Morgan or Teddy Roosevelt, are you thinking Doctorow? Because he's going to be on here in a few weeks. And I was just, you know, I mean, they come alive as real characters and fictional characters and then merge in your imagination?
Yes. I mean, you know, Doctorow has made the modern strike at that way of writing, but it really goes back to Melville, who, you know, wrote a novel in which he has Ben Franklin as a character and such. You know, if you become a public figure, watch out. You may appear in somebody's novel.
We'll go to more of our callers, and we'll go next to Anne. Join us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Anne.
It's a pleasure to hear this interview because I think that Alan Chews is one of the best reviewers. I can sort of count on him.
Well, thank you.
And I'd also like to know whether you have any ideas as to why a wonderful novelist and short story writer who spends half a year in America and half in Nigeria, Chimamanda Adichie,
yes,
is not better known in this country and better celebrated.
Well, you know, she's getting known very quickly. You know, she's gotten huge awards and recognition, and I think she's a wonderful writer. She's very young. You know, she's in there's a group of very, very talented Nigerian novelists that have followed in the footsteps of Chinua Achebe. One of them is my colleague at George Mason. His name is Helon Habila. And there's Chris Abani who teaches in Southern California. And Chimamanda is a bit younger than these folks, but she is certainly making her way. And I think, you know, next week she'll be better known than she is now. And you'll see, you know, next year or two, she'll be better known. So I wouldn't worry about her, but she is wonderful.
Were you familiar with the Nobel laureate, the Romanian writer?
I had read one of those books, The Land of Green Plums, But I was surprised and shocked, and, you know, it sort of raises my patriotic hackles that, you know, they keep ignoring Americans.
I kept thinking, in fact, Margaret Atwood was on last week, and she said she was superstitious about it and hoped she wouldn't win. But you know, Philip Roth, your New Jersey boy, should be overdue for one, wouldn't you think?
I think so. I think so. And he certainly picks up political themes, which appeals to the Nobel Committee.
Well, the Nobel Committee seems to go often for writers who are lesser known. I mean, you look down the list of Nobel recipients for literature and...
you don't find the name James Joyce or Leo Tolstoy, that's for sure.
Or you find Sinclair Lewis, who Philip Roth said was one of the worst writers of American literature. He was when The Plot Against America came out, I was interviewing him about it. And there was a book that Lewis did that you may know of, It Can't Happen Here.
Yes.
And Ross said he didn't read it until after he'd written The Plot Against America, and he thought it was dreadful. But Hemingway won a Nobel, and O'Neill won a Nobel. I mean, a number of Americans have won the Nobel, but not – you look down the list, and there are a lot of writers you wouldn't know. I mean, Americans – being few, but nonetheless, world writers you wouldn't know.
Look down the list of the Swedish writers who won it, and you don't know any of those.
Let me also ask you a little bit, because I would be remiss if I didn't, about the difference between writing short stories and writing novels as you see it.
What I've learned over the years is that writing stories is as close as I can get to writing poems. I mean, I'm not a poet. I'm not a very good poet. I wouldn't be a good poet, but somehow I try to make the stories word by word and line by line the way somebody composes a poem. So, stories do, for me at least, tend towards the lyric, as I say, tend toward poetry. Novels are, what did James use that phrase to attack Tolstoy? Loose, baggy monsters. I love a wonderful, loose, baggy monster of a novel, you know, a novel you can live in for days and weeks and maybe even months, and then go back again and back to in 10 years if you really loved it and see it in different
the light. Saturation novel. That was, remember, the big debate between James and Wells about the selective novel versus the saturation novel. Talking about good poetry, in reading your work, I was reminded of a wonderful poem by Sharon Olds, which I'd sort of filed away in my consciousness, Sex Without Love, went back and read it, because you were using it as an example of the difference between motion and action. And usually when people think of sex, they think of action, you know, getting action and all that sort of thing. But you've had it kind of in a different frame. And talk about that, because it was fascinating.
That distinction for me goes back to a preface that Hemingway wrote to, I think it's the second edition of For Whom the Bell Tolls. He describes sitting on the veranda of a ski resort in Sun Valley with Marlene Dietrich. And he's reading the paper. She's watching the skiers on the hillside and swats the paper aside. And she says, "Look, Papa, look," and points to the skiers. And he looks up at the slope and goes back behind his paper and says, "Daughter, don't confuse motion with action." And I think, you know, that in the Hemingway sentence, and I think Ralph Ellison has pointed this out in one of his essays, we get the purest concentration of the movement of language towards another place or another state when he rubs his nouns against his verbs. So he makes that distinction in his work. His sentences come alive.
He called it the iceberg effect, you know. That was his way of describing what's beneath those sentences. But remember, Wyndham Lewis said it was dumb ox sentences.
Well, you know, Wyndham Lewis, you know, when that's another story. But if you look at a Hemingway story in great detail, and I happen to teach Big Two-Hearted River parts one and two a lot to my students.
And some long sentences in there.
I think it's really like a Sibelius symphony. Very long, complex sentences in there alongside the characteristic Hemingway short declarative sentences. He knows how to move language and transform movement into action.
It's funny, a lot of people thought that was just a fishing story until Malcolm Cowley came along and said, look, you know, this is a story about a man who's been wounded psychically and, you know, coming back to set up his camp and then catching the fish. Like you say, the sentences become long and elegant.
And he uses
motion and action.
And I mean, I see that story now, and maybe I'll see it differently. That I didn't see this 10 years ago, but it's really like a Zen meditation. It's like a reading meditation. He's on a meditative quest to restore his soul, Nick Adams is. He's nicked, he's scarred, he's marred, but he's also Adamic at the same time, huh? And he walks through every stage of the evolution or the re-evolution of his soul by camping, fishing, cooking pancakes over the fire. It's all prayer.
And thinking of Hopi. Talking with
on the Black River.
Alan Chu's, what did you think about the Booker recipient this year, Hillary Mantel?
I haven't read that. I probably will. It's on my file.
I think it's Mantel, actually.
Mantel, yeah. I did read a good novel of hers about, a woman living in Saudi Arabia and trying to establish her soul before going mad because of all the repression. But I haven't read a lot of her work. And so I'll get to this at some point. But, you know, the Brits love history about themselves, and that's what they've gotten in this novel.
The Swedes love politics and the Brits love history, I think, when it comes to prizes, is sort of the operating principles here.
So what do we love as Americans?
What do we Americans love? Well, that's what you've been looking for, isn't it?
Yeah.
And your quest and your odyssey. We've got a caller from up in Boston, Massachusetts. Jack, hi.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. I'm out here visiting in the Bay Area, so I'm calling you from my iPhone. Mm-hmm. I'm an aspiring novelist. I've been a nonfiction writer most of my life. Mm-hmm. And, Alan, my question for you is, what do you look for in the first chapter of a novel to decide whether or not you want to review it?
It's got to pull me in, Jack, in some way, shape, or form, whether through the language or a certain portent in the description of the characters. But
Ralph Nader didn't do that for you?
I think if he'd supplied some of the super rich cash along with that book, we all might like it better. But in any case, there's no single prescription that I have. It's just got to have that, what is Thomas Jefferson called, a certain je ne sais quoi, a feeling. It has to create a feeling, it has to create a mood, and it has to make us want to go further. My dear late friend John Gardner used to call it profluence. It's got to give us a sensation of forward movement.
How did you know Gardner?
Gardner. Gardner is my idol.
Well
he's my God.
He was Raymond Carver's great mentor, of course. And how do you know him?
I knew John. We don't have enough time for me to go into the whole story, but let's just say I was teaching at Bennington in the mid 70s. And I reviewed Sunlight Dialogues, not Nickel Mountain, Sunlight Dialogues for The Nation, and said, hey, we have to get this guy to come and read for our students. And my friend Nick DelBanco was there teaching also, and he read the same work and loved it. And so we decided to invite Gardner. I knew the widow of his editor, a writer named Laurie Siegel, called her, got his phone number, and we...
You tracked him down.
Tracked him down, called him up, invited him.
Was he at Chico State then?
No, he was at Southern Illinois in Carbondale.
Oh, yeah, right.
And he appeared at the Albany airport, stepped off a small plane with his shoulder-length platinum blonde hair in his reading cape, his purple reading cape. And Joan, his then wife, was dressed all in leather, looked like a woman you might see, in Pigalle. And... he came to the DelBanco farmhouse that night for dinner. I guess we got there about 8 o'clock at 2 in the morning. He had, and I don't mean to celebrate this kind of drinking, but this is just what he did. He had finished off himself about a fifth of vodka, and the rest of us were pretty woozy. And 5 in the morning, we dropped him at his motel. At 8 o'clock, I crawled back there after 2 hours sleep to take him to his round of meetings with students. He taught 2 classes, had lunch with students, taught 2 more classes, had dinner with students, gave his reading, and then there was a huge party. And at 2 that morning, he said, I love this place. I'd love to come and teach here. And DelBanco and I just stood on our hind legs and said, wow, whoopee. And so we went to the president of the college, whose name was Gail Parker. I think at the time she was... either the only female college president or the youngest college president or maybe both. And we said, this wonderful writer, we could hardly speak. You know, he's as good as Chekhov. You know, we want him here. He wants to come here. He's sending his CV. She said, well, I haven't read him. And, you know, the trustees just gave me this endowed position for the science people. I'll just take it back from them and give it to your fellow gardener. Well, that began her downfall. But he came for 2 years and, you know, we all just, you know, loved each other.
Well, he was a writer's writer.
A wonderful man.
And a wonderful teacher. And he told a story splendidly. It's a good story. Let me go to more of our callers. We'll get Phyllis on next. Hi, Phyllis.
Oh, hi. Yes, I admire Alan Chiz's work. I also write the reviews for the, and you didn't mention the Chronicle, and God knows we need all the publicity we can get.
Oh, yeah, the Chronicle. You know, the Chronicle, I believe now, is the second freestanding book review in the nation after
exactly.
The New York Times.
And therein lies a quick story, because we had a big fight over that. They were going to take it out.
I remember that.
We did a program, and as a result of that program, I'm proud to say it was kept. Yeah, I'm sorry, Phyllis. Go ahead.
Oh, I had one more question because I do admire and want your opinion. Have you seen Bright Star yet, the film about Keats?
No, I haven't. But
it's fabulous.
It's on my list.
I've seen it twice already, and I want.
Yeah, I heard it was a clunker, Phyllis. I'm sorry, from a good source of mine.
Oh no,
that's beautiful film, supposedly by
don't
that
believe it.
Jane Campion, that Australian filmmaker. Yeah,
maybe it's a woman's film, but I've seen it twice in a week already.
Well,
it's that good. But I wondered what Alan Chiz thought of Keats' work. I was not.
Oh,
that
I love Keats, Phyllis. I love Keats. I keep his collected poems right at my work table.
They recite them all through the film. If nothing else, that makes it worth seeing. Thank you.
Thank you for the film review, too, Phyllis. Good to hear from you. Here's Neil, who writes, Michael, enjoying hearing about Alan Chiz's book, Trance After Breakfast. I'm from Jersey City, and my trip to Bali in 1992 was truly transformational. It cured my Vietnam post-traumatic distress.
Wow. Neil, there's an answer here. We need to send everybody in Jersey to Bali. though the island would sink under the weight of all of us. No, I'm glad to hear that I'm, you know, I wasn't living in an isolated condition.
Did you see Jersey Boys,
no,
the musical?
No, I haven't seen it.
Actually, you know, it's funny. On the face of it, the Four Seasons, and maybe you didn't like that music. I mean, a lot of people didn't, because it was kind of pop music and everything. But the story is pretty engaging. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, the story is very engaging, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll put it on my list right after Keats' movie.
let's go to more of our callers. From Oakland, Ed. Hi, you're on.
Hi. Very curious about the story of the minister who went to Tijuana to convert people to Judaism.
Yes.
On three counts. One is the traditional ambivalence Judaism has toward conversion.
Mm-hmm.
The second is why he wanted to get the bishop's permission, and the most curious part is why the bishop gave it.
Yeah, well, I guess if you look at the population of Tijuana at the time, you know, 99.9% Catholic, and I don't think he worried too much about too many converts. You know, he wasn't going to lose too many sheep from his flock, and I guess he accepted the courtesy of the almost rabbi going to him. Another story about that, though, is at one point, one of the members of the Tijuana cartel came to the rabbi, stopped him on the street and said, I hear you know a lot about the Bible. And the man said, yeah, I know something about it. And he said, I would like you to teach my children the Bible. And the near rabbi said, excuse me, but I cannot do that for you. At which point, the drug gangster looked at him and said, I respect your what you're saying, and I want you to know that no harm will come to you.
Let me thank the caller. You were also right about Hernando Alvaso in that essay.
Hernando Alonso, yeah, who is the, according to the records of the Mexican Inquisition, the first Jew to be burned at the stake during the Mexican Inquisition. And that interesting leap from that research I did for that essay into a long short story that I wrote about him called Hernando Alonso. It very, very rich material. So I took three lines from the annals of the Mexican Inquisition and turned it into a 40-page short story, which I hope, keeps them alive.
A lot of people don't know there was a Mexican Inquisition. I mean, they associate the Inquisition, of course, with the continent, mm-hmm. and not here. We're talking to Alan Chews, who is NPR book reviewer for All Things Considered, author of A Trance After Breakfast and To Catch the Lightning. And you're welcome to join us in the time remaining. It's toll-free 866-733-6786 or send an email to forum@kqed.org. And George writes, worth noting that we now have, thanks to Milestone Films and to you, if you did have something to do with this, DVD edition of Edward Curtis's 1914 motion picture In the Land of the War Canoes. Any comment?
There's a fellow at Rutgers, a member of the Rutgers English Department, who refurbished that film and added some of the music that Curtis had recorded. And I think there's a deal going on now about which company is going to bring it out on DVD. But it takes the Land of the Headhunters into a new edition, into a new phase. About the music, there are about 40,000 wax cylinders that Curtis and his assistant, William Myers, recorded during the course of their work with the Western tribes, all of it in the ethnic music library at the University of Indiana. Most of it unplayable. These discs are so fragile, but they've restored some, and that will be on the soundtrack of this restored version of Land of the Headhunters whenever it does appear on DVD.
Talk a little bit about the title, To Catch the Lightning.
I see that. I mean, that the line comes out of the Upanishads, and Myers, his assistant, says that to him. He says, "You're trying to. You might as well be trying to catch the lightning." He says this in the middle of their work on the Hopi rain dance, snake dance. But it seems to me that's the ephemeral nature of his project, that he's trying to capture that moment where North American Indian culture extends to its fullest just before the bloom falls off and modern life begins to fully eat away at all, you know, thousands of years of tradition and culture.
Do you read Native American novelists like Louise Erdrich and Sherman Alexie? And
oh, yeah.
Leslie Silko, are you drawn to them?
Yes. I've been reading them for decades. Silko is a fine story writer. She's got a collection out called Storyteller, which is some of her photographs. I mean, that title story is amazing. Also, The Man to Send Rain Clouds in that same collection is wonderful. But let's not leave out James Welch, who's also he's a
but Idaho, Montana, Blackfeet. I think. Yes. Still,
yeah. And his novel, he's dead now, alas. But his novel, The Indian Lawyer, is one of my favorite novels.
Hmm. Well, talking about favorite novels, Gary says, does Alan Chews have any thoughts about novelist John Fante? Fante, is it, or Fant? I'm currently reading everything he wrote, and I'm puzzled why he's not more well known. Do you know him?
He was a project of Black Sparrow Press. They published him when no one else would publish him. And
is it Fante or
Fante? I believe it's Fante. Yeah, Italian American. He's at least as good as say Erskine Caldwell or some of the other naturalist writers. He writes about a time and a place.
Right, about Tobacco Road type novels?
He talks about L.A. culture down among the proletariat, and I think he's very good. Somebody should write about him.
Speaking of Italian-American writers, it's always been a bit mysterious to me why, other than Don DeLillo and I suppose you could say Mario Puzo, we don't have more of them in our canon. I mean, they're great American Italian filmmakers, for example, and you know, there's a extraordinary number of African-American, Jewish-American novelists, but Italians who have this great storytelling tradition and have had great numbers here and literary people haven't played as preeminent a role by any stretch in American.
I think you have a point there, although, you know, with the novel One Can Never Tell, it may well be that next week some Italian-American, you know, fourth generation or fifth generation Italian-American will produce a novel that will knock us all onto our knees.
So speaking about knocked on the knees, what did you think about Oates' new novel?
I loved it. I thought it was a kind of variation on Crime and Punishment, an American Crime and Punishment. The crime is quite distant. All the punishment is up front.
It's also, because I did have an opportunity to read it, I thought a novel that had kind of polemic agenda. I know that sounds makes people recoil when they hear that because it sounds too didactic or something. But she was really talking about how, especially in that particular period, how terrible the American jurisprudence system was.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that. I hope it's improved, but it really comes down very hard on you if you have no money, and uses rumor and innuendo in ways that we just don't think should be proper. The father of the main character is basically driven to suicide by the fact that he was arrested but not charged for a vile crime, and he's looked the people in the community look on him differently after that, and the daughter lives with that stigma.
There's that small town provinciality too that she captures. One of the things that always amazes me about her is how she maintains a kind of super awareness of working class life, despite the fact that she left it so many years ago.
Well, you know, we all feel that. I mean, I got out of Jersey, but I still feel like I'm there.
Can you still write about Jersey, though, and about it with authenticity?
I've written very little about Jersey.
Yeah, see.
Some in my memoir, you know, this memoir, Fall Out of Heaven, that I wrote long before memoir was cool, I have to say.
Is memoir cool? Yeah.
But very little else.
Alan Chu, our guest this hour, book critic for National Public Radio's All Things Considered and the author of A Trance After Breakfast, which is a collection of travel essays, and the novel To Catch the Lightning. Those are his most recent works. He'll also be again at Book Passage in Corte Madera on October 14th and at Get Lost Travel Bookstore in San Francisco on October 15th. And pleasure to have you with us.
Great pleasure to talk with you, Michael.
Thank you, Alan. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Tomorrow we're going to have some memories about the Loma Prieta earthquake as we approach the 20th anniversary. And we hope you will join us for that. I always remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum simply by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in response line, which is 415-553-3300. Extend our thanks to our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and to our producers, Kevin Guillory, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.